Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to change the page, turn the page, if you will, and consider what Yahweh had to say in his Torah. It was an interesting statement that crossed my eye this morning as I was preparing for the program. Well, we have to be a little suspect of it because it's in a portion of Revelation that is past the 17th chapter, and we don't have any affirmation of anything that was said prior to Constantine's malfeasance of Revelation past chapter 17. It is interesting that we do read, blessed are they, that means receiving benefit, are they that engage in his instructions, speaking of Yahweh's instructions. So receiving benefit and blessed are those who act upon and engage in his instructions, that they have the right to the tree of life, and that they may enter through the doorway into the city. The city, of course, is the new Jerusalem, and the instructions are found in Yahweh's book of instructions called the Torah. And the tree of life, of course, is a reference to what Yahusha did to enable the covenant's benefits and fulfill Passover. And so it's here we have God himself explaining what the purpose was of the tree of life and what it represents. So if we return back to the statement that we were considering from Yahweh at the conclusion of yesterday's program, this is what we read. Yahweh said to Cain, why are you enraged and jealous? Why is your face fallen? Why is your head down? Well, why not? Cain answered. So God said, if you are properly positioned, having a good time, and if you are agreeable and pleasant to be around, Yatab, if you are joyful and happy as a result of being treated mercifully and generously, and you're pleasing and good and appropriately prepared and established, you'll find forgiveness and a high status, the removal of guilt, rising up, standing up, dignity and honor, majesty even. But if you aren't celebrating and pleasing, if you aren't joyful and happy as a result of being treated mercifully and generously, then sin, guilt, is crouching down in the opening, in the doorway. You are into yourself, and your intense desires and impulses are things you must learn to control. And so here we have God speaking of the means to resolve the kinds of disputes that Cain himself was engaging in. Cain didn't listen to God, came up with a sacrifice that was not acceptable to God. But God has built the plan to resolve mankind's unwillingness to listen to him, which is the consequence of failing to listen to him and therefore of sin, is death. God designed a plan to resolve that. He designed a plan also to deal with the punishment associated with sin, which is separation from him. And that plan begins with the seven Moed Mikre, which are chag, celebrations, parties. And so God has said, if you want to come back to the place where good times are had by all in the Garden of Great Joy, if this is what you want, you need to attend my festival feast, my parties. You need to be willing to celebrate life, to have a good time, to be agreeable, to be pleasant to be around. And if you're not, if you're going to disregard them, then sin is crouching at the opening, at the doorway, and you're way too into yourself, which is the nature of religion. It's people are way too into their own feelings. You know, I feel like God changed my life. I feel like I feel wonderful when I go to a praise concert. It's all about feelings. It's not about facts. It's not about understanding. It's not about analysis and consideration. Now, God does want us happy. And the best way to be happy is to act upon his advice. And his most vital guidance is to answer his invitations to meet with him during his seven annual festival feasts, the celebrations of the Mikre. And therein lies the entire purpose of the discussion. Abel followed Yah's lead, and Cain did not. One found himself accepted and favorably regarded, and the other was ignored and rejected. Heaven is for those who God values, and God values those who value him. Now, Cain's issues are central to mankind's problems. We are all too often guided by our emotions rather than our minds. That is to say, we rely on our nefesh soul, our consciousness, our animal nature, instead of our nesama, conscience, the ability to be discerning, discriminating, judgmental, and rational. As such, political and religious individuals coveting sex, power, and money have mercilessly and without constraint robbed and raped the masses without interruption for a better part of 6,000 years. Cain's problem is mankind's, our unwillingness to listen to God. Man's animal nature roars to the forefront, killing all that is good. Cain didn't listen, and carried away by cravings and rage, he murdered Abel. Then, when God asked about the killing and what happened, he lied. He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's observer?" Guardian, protector, shamar. You know, the shamar is one of the most active verbs in the whole of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. You know, where I think kara may be the single most important term, which means to read and recite, to be called out, to be invited, to be welcomed, to meet with God. Shamar is equally vital. It means to closely examine and carefully consider, to observe. He says, "I don't know what happened to my brother. Well, am I supposed to be observing him?" is the question and the answer. Abel's blood cried out from the ground. So as a consequence of having murdered him, Cain was cursed. That is to say, in retribution for what he had done, Yahweh sends him to be afflicted. He said, this is God speaking to Cain. He says, "When you work the earth, the adamah, the ground, it shall no longer produce a healthy crop. Your strength, your potential, your power will be shaken, and it will waver and it will wither. And you will wander away aimlessly like a nomad and fugitive in the region." Ah, that was the killer, the last one. You see, Cain had been disenfranchised. He not only committed a grievous sin, he rejected Yahweh's means to reconcile the relationship, which is the sacrificial lamb. He did not listen to God. Instead, he was self-centered. And so, cast out of Yahweh's family, cast out of Yahweh's plan, he no longer had the potential to inherit Yah's power, and therefore his potential withered. And he was not alone on the wrong path. He was alone in the sense that he was estranged from God, but there are so many people, the vast majority of people, who have aimlessly staggered to nowhere and to nothing, following the religions that they prefer. But the key to understanding this passage is, for mortal man, separation from God is the penalty for sin, not death. This realization is so important, it will be underscored in the next verse. You see, separation from God is the penalty of sin. That's why on Matzah, Yahusha's soul went to Sheol to ransom us from the penalty of sin. The consequence of sin is death. Death is not a penalty. Having known Yah and his company in better times, Cain said to Yahweh, "The consequence of sin, of Awon, is great, is enormous, substantial, and severe, more than I can bear, that I can tolerate or endure. It's too big a debt." Nasa. "Behold, today you have driven me away, Garas. You have expelled and divorced me, removing me from your presence, from the presence of the ground, and from your presence is being concealed. It's being kathar, hidden." This is Bar Rashith, Genesis 4:13-14. In this case, the debtor connotation of Nassau works quite nicely. For Cain to regain access to Yahweh, redemption would be required. But what Cain was saying here is that, you know, I can't tolerate this. I can't endure this. I can't bear it. All based upon the concept of Nassau. And what he couldn't bear was the penalty, being excommunicated from God, separated from God, estranged from God, being outside of the covenant is the issue at stake here. Now, many Christians are deceived into believing that Jesus' supposed death on the cross formed the basis of their salvation. Now, beyond the fact that his name was not Jesus, and that Jesus destroys any chance of knowing who he actually is, and that God cannot die, and that the pagan symbols the Christian tout is not the appearance of the upright pole that was served as the doorway to life or Passover on Mount Moriah, and that a cross is a purely pagan symbol. Apart from all of those things, putting aside even that God cannot die, the penalty for sin isn't death. It is separation. That is what this statement is emphasizing. The sequence of events depicted on Moriah's upright pole are essential to our redemption, yet they are missed by most everyone, especially Christians. First, Yahusha celebrated Passover with his disciples. Then on the same day, because the Hebrew day, the scriptural day, begins at sundown and ends at sundown, on the same day, following the sunset celebration of Pesach with his disciples, Yahusha became the sacrificial lamb, the Passover lamb. Prior to his last breath, Yahweh's spirit departed Yahusha. And the reason for that is that Yahweh's spirit cannot die because it's eternal. And part of that is because Yahweh's spirit cannot go to the place of separation, which is where Yahusha's soul was going. Yahusha's physical body as the Passover lamb died, was sacrificed. But his soul, which is the essence of his consciousness, it did not die because it went into the place of separation, into Sheol. And on that night, being consistent with the Torah, his body was destroyed. So as we consider what occurred in 33 CE, which was year 4000 Yah, and attempt to make sense of what occurred, to be consistent with Yah's testimony regarding what occurred, it is important that we recognize that Yahusha, on what was a Thursday evening in the year 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, celebrated Passover with his disciples. It was not the Last Supper, it was Passover. And everything he said and did during Passover pertained to Passover. For exactly, he said, we know when you break this bread and you drink this wine, do so in remembrance of me. It's remembrance of the role that he was playing on our behalf on Passover, Matzah, and Bukurim, the three successive events, the three festival feasts of Yahweh that take place each spring. And so he was going to serve as the Passover lamb, and he wanted his disciples to recognize the reference to the bread and to the wine as it relates to the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. And so that same day, from a scriptural point of view, where the day begins at sunset and ends at sunset, now Friday prior to sunset, he served as the Passover lamb. Prior to his body as the Passover lamb dying, his spirit went back to heaven. That's why he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then his consciousness or his soul departed and went into Sheol, the place of separation, for the purpose of exonerating us, paying a ransom to free us from the penalty of our own sin. That night, his body was destroyed, in keeping with the Torah's teaching as to what happens to the remains of the Passover lamb. Therefore, there could not have been a bodily resurrection. And Then, on matzah, his soul endured the torment of separation. So that on firstborn children, or bukurim, Yahusha's soul and Yahweh's spirit were reunited. And a new child was born, a completely reformed, renewed creation. And this is the kind of existence that we will enjoy as we are enabled to celebrate Bukurim for real in Yahweh's presence. We become spiritual. We become energy-based. We will be able to transform any portion of our spiritual energy into matter when it serves our interest, and we will be energy-based when that is more beneficial, which it will be the vast majority of the time. That's why he was able to instantly appear on earth, but unrecognizable. It's why he's told the women in his life not to touch him outside the garden. It's why then he said he was going to the Father, which he could do as an energy-based entity now, and why he could instantly teleport to and transport his energy and then appear physically on the road to Emmaus, 60 stadia from Jerusalem. Why he was not recognized there, because it wasn't the same body. And why then he could leave them after dining with them and suddenly appear coming through the wall of the upper room, and why his disciples did not recognize him, which was the only common theme of all of the Bukurim testimony. He was not recognizable. And so that is what happened on those 3 days. And Yahusha sacrifices. The eyewitness accounts aren't best presented in Yahochanan or Matanyah, but are instead most accurately and vividly presented in Psalm 22, Psalm 88, Yashaya Isaiah 53. There you will find eyewitness accounts of precisely what would and did occur, provided by God himself, explaining what happened on Passover, matzah, and Bukurim, and why those days were so important to our well-being. Now, Cain goes on to lament that apart from God's company, direction, and protection, he says, I shall stagger and be shaken, wandering aimlessly like a fugitive in the region. And it will be, and it shall be that anyone who finds out about me will kill me. Harag will put me to death. So there's some insights here that are really worth considering. If you are into yourself, if you're way too much occupied with your own feelings, if you're not willing to listen to God, if you ignore God's advice in terms of how to engage in the covenant, then you are going to stagger and be shaken, and you're going to wander aimlessly like a fugitive. That is the reality. There's only one way back into the Garden of Eden, into God's home, and that is to embrace his instructions, to listen to him and to act upon him, and not throw a tizzy fit to say, I hate your way. I'm going to ignore your way. I'm mad as hell that you're being so uncompromising here and aren't willing to consider my way. And that's what's going to happen to all those who are religious. They're going to stagger, wandering aimlessly, just like Cain. Yes, indeed. There are two interesting insights in this statement from Genesis 14:4, Bereshith in the beginning. It says, I shall stagger, wandering aimlessly like a fugitive in the land or in the region. And that is really the nature of this. If you're not willing to listen to God's guidance on how to reestablish your relationship with him, which Cain was unwilling to do, which Christians are unwilling to do, then you wander aimlessly like a fugitive. You are lost and excluded from a relationship with God. And then the second part of this is also insightful for what it infers. And it shall be that anyone who finds out about me, they will kill me. Well, if he's killed his brother and he's only got his mom and dad there, and he's speaking of any others that all others, Cole, that find out about him. Now, he's certainly not talking about wolves that are going to say, well, you know, that guy's a murderer, and we wolves, that's the one thing we won't tolerate, is someone who kills. You couldn't be talking about, orcas having a little chat out there in the ocean and say, you know, that guy, he's a murderer, and we orcas, that's the one thing we won't do, is we'll never kill. We won't tolerate somebody that will kill. No, he's talking about the existence of other Homo sapiens who instinctively knew that killing was, particularly killing your own brother, was a bad thing. And so what this says is right there at the onset that there were other Homo sapiens that were living outside of the garden. And it shall be that anyone who finds out about me will try to kill me. Now, if there were only three people on the planet at this time, mom, dad, and the wayward son, this statement would be absurd. But that's not the case, which is why Cain was worried others would discover what he had done and would kill him for having done so. While separation is God's penalty for rebellion, mankind has imposed the death penalty for murder throughout most of recorded history. God has been absolutely and abundantly clear. Animals were created on the fifth day, and mammals, to which the species Homo sapiens belongs, were formed early on the sixth day. According to Scripture, man, like every other animal, has a nephesh soul or consciousness. According to God, that means with a nephesh soul, by the way, you are aware of your environment. You can observe your environment and respond to it. That's what a soul enables you to do. According to Yahweh, the very thing that made Adam unique was his nesama, or his conscience. It is what caused him to be the first living soul that was created in God's image, a being able to be moral and distinguish between good and bad, to be able to reason, to be judgmental. Every scriptural indication is that humans without a nesama existed in the deadly realm outside of Eden's protection. This verse is one of many which confirm this scientific reality. It is so utterly stupid for those who promote Christianity to say that the earth is only 6,000 years old and that Adam was the first human, when all of the evidence is to the contrary, including God's own testimony. Interesting in this regard is that it was announced in August of 2007, as when I was first writing this material that we are reviewing now, that the alleged evolutionary tree depicting man evolving from chimp to Homo habilis to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens over the course of a million years was shown to be untrue. Homo habilis and now Homo erectus, both of which are far more ape than man, lived at exactly the same time, which, of course, destroys the whole myth of macroevolution. And if it were not enough to scuttle macroevolutionary theory by itself, tooth analysis has recently demonstrated that the notion that all humans evolved from Africa is also invalid. The purpose of this next passage, oh, by the way, one other thing is kind of interesting. The oldest skeletal remains we have of Homo sapiens was found in Israel. It's in a cave in Israel. I found a whole extended family, children, mothers, daughters, sons, men, both young and old, all dating back to about 100,000 years ago, indicating that Homo sapiens existed at least 94,000 years before Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden, before this conversation was taking place. The purpose of this next statement is to teach us that Yahweh reserves the right to judge individual lives. While we are called to expose and condemn false teachers and teachings, the determination of personal guilt as it relates to his standard and the sentence, such as, such behavior or conclusions or actions receive, is God's alone to make. As a result, Yah sought to protect Cain from other humans. Now, before I share what God had to say to him, because Yah's testimony is so completely inconsistent with the religion of Christianity and with religions like Islam, You know, I'm very often asked by people who are hearing it for the first time that they want to know whether their mother or father or some relative who they just loved, who has passed away, but passed away clinging to a religious myth, is saved. And, you know, my response is always, no, I'm not in the business, not my pay, way above my pay grade, to make a determination on an individual's fate. But I can tell you about the big picture, that Yahweh has a specific plan, a specific path that leads home, and that if you embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, if you answer the invitations to meet with him on the festival feast known as the Mikre, you walk through that doorway of life known as Passover and across the threshold that cleans your soul of matzah, and therefore celebrate being adopted into his family on Bukurim, you're empowered and enriched by God on Shavuot, I can tell you that you're going to spend your eternity with Yahweh. And God's given us his word on it. And I can tell you that if you choose to embrace a religious myth instead, something that's contrary, you don't listen to God and you prefer your own way or a man's way, that you're going to be either eternally estranged from him based upon advocating these false doctrines, or at the end of a person's mortal existence, that will be the end of it. Their soul will be extinguished. They will cease to exist. That's what God says. Now, as it relates to Aunt Mabel, I don't know. I'm not interested in knowing. Don't care to know. Don't want to know. Don't know. And not my job. Our job is to expose lies while witnessing to the truth. That we can do. We can tell people what is reliable for them, because it's what's reliable for everyone. But as it relates to judging an individual, apart from the individual's proclamations, which are either political or religious, not something that we're called to do. Then Yahweh said to him, assuredly, anyone who slays Cain shall experience sevenfold retribution. And Yahweh placed a sign on Cain, lest someone who discovered him strike him. This is Genesis 4:13 and 14. Do you think that Yahweh was telling us he was going to put a sign on him to keep the sharks at bay? You ever seen a sign on the bottom of the surfboard that says, shark, there is a person on top of the surfboard, not a seal. I would appreciate it if you not bite the surfer. And you think the sign is going to prevail? You know, if you're out in the middle of Africa, and been noticed by a pride of lions, you think having a sign on your forehead that says, you know, I'm a person, and because us people, I guess we do hunt lions, so we'll forget all about that. I'm a person, but I'd appreciate if you not eat me. That's going to work? Or have written words only communicated effectively among Homo sapiens. And therefore, when God says, I'm going to put a sign on Cain so that those who discover him don't strike him, he is affirming that Homo sapiens, who could read, existed outside of the garden at the time of Adam and Chawa's expulsion. That is what he is conveying. So here we find additional proof that there were humans around who could read, or at the very least, who had the capacity to interpret a sign. It would be senseless to think that wild animals were going to behave differently based upon a sign that God was going to put on Cain and was going to punish carnivores. That God said, all right, boy, that's cheetah, that hedgehog. For striking Cain and thinking he's food, boy, I'm going to really punish that wolf. I mean, it's absurd. Man, it's just so sad that people are willing to take things from out of context and draw conclusions that are inconsistent with the the evidence that's being provided for us. There's no indication that Adam and Chawa were the only humans to exist on the planet. They were just the only humans made in God's image, protected by him and engaging in the relationship in the Garden of Great Joy. And when they were expelled, they had to interact with others. One of Christendom's greatest myths, that of Adam being the only man in existence during his stay in Eden, is again pulverized by God's testimony. Then Cain went away, it reads, from the presence of Yahweh and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Well, the land of Nod, which means lamenting and destitution, hopelessness, east of Eden, is that the land was named after an individual, Nod. Places were named after people, or at least types of people. Nod denotes the nomadic lifestyle of the early hunter-gatherer, something as a farmer Cain would have loathed. You see, Nod speaks of homeless wanderings. And so it was in the land of the hunter-gatherers that Cain was to settle. And this certainly infers that there were not only people, but societies of individuals. We'll be back in a moment. So after being banished, Cain found a woman among the nomads of Nod, and he chose to marry her. Though it does not say so implicitly, it is implied that the men and women living outside of the garden did not possess a Nesama conscience, but that the offspring of a parent like Cain with a Nesama would be so equipped. So the children of a parent with a Nesama would inherit their father or mother's Nesama. It is the only rational explanation which can be made from the scriptural and archaeological evidence at our disposal. Along these lines, we know that the addition of a Nesama made Adam uniquely different from other animals. It is also, therefore, what made Adam like God. Further, we know that the children inherit a Nesama from their parents because Cain would not have been judged if he were incapable of knowing right from wrong. Further, this point is hammered home in the introduction to the fifth chapter of Bereshith Genesis, something we're going to examine momentarily, or at least in our program tomorrow. And lastly, in the conclusion to the flood, Yahweh specifically declares that he achieved his purpose, that of ridding the region of corrupt souls with an Nesama, and only those with an Nesama. Collectively, these insights strongly suggest that both the Nesama conscience, which is the seat of judgment, and the Nefesh consciousness, which is our source of awareness, and our ability to respond, our soul, are passed on as part of human conception. The child of a parent with one gets one. Now, that always brings up the question, do I think anyone alive today is devoid of an Nesama? And I have no way of knowing, but I suspect not. I suspect that having an Nesama was so advantageous for Homo sapiens that those that did not were ultimately were in a position where it would be extraordinarily difficult for them to effectively reproduce and to maintain a society against Homo sapiens within the Nesama. So my strong conclusion is that everyone alive today has a Nesama, but it's also my conclusion that the vast preponderance of people, and it's probably 99.999% of people today, for either religious reasons or political reasons, political correctness reasons, underuse or totally neglect the purpose of their Nesama. So even having one, it doesn't necessarily benefit somebody unless they're willing to use it. Cain was unwilling to use his, and you can see where it got him. So then you may be wondering, why, you know, are there humans today, as I've pondered, without a Nesama? And it's possible, but we certainly aren't told. Now, if it is true, it would certainly explain some of the horrid behavior that we've seen throughout human history. However, while we don't need to know if consciousness souls or consciousless souls exist today, nor need to understand their fate, it would be reasonable to assume that their destiny would be the same as any other animal. Death would simply be the end of life. And it's true even for humans with an asama. If you have an asama, you don't use it, and you don't come to know what God said, you don't come to know Yahweh, and you don't embrace what he's offering, then just like any other animal, even though you have an asama, the fact that you didn't deploy it will mean that death will be the end of your life. Now, if you are not yet convinced that yada, to know, is a relational word, meaning more than just to know, but to know in a relational sense, to be aware of, to acknowledge, to respect, to be acquainted with, then this next passage, like the previous one in relation to Adam Chawa in Genesis 4:1, makes it perfectly clear. It says, Cain became acquainted with, yada, came to know his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Hanok. Now, Hanok means, meaning initiated, which is transliterated Enoch. This idea of yada, and the first book that I wrote based upon Yahweh's testimony was called Yada Yah, which is to know Yah, to be acquainted with him, to acknowledge him, to even to understand him. But yada, in this sense, is a relational term. It speaks of knowing in a relational context. And so Cain, yada, his wife, Esau, the woman, and therefore she conceived and gave birth to Hanok. Now we're going to consider what happened with Hanok and the uniqueness of Hanok when Shatteringness continues this time tomorrow. Between now and then, may God bless.